Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. This Friday from 6 to 8 p.m., the Corkscrew is holding a wine tasting hosted by Count Sebastione Caponi from the Villa Calcinea estate in Tuscany, family winemakers for centuries. This is his first visit to Champaign-Urbana. Information at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. And we're having some difficulty reaching our guest this afternoon, the guest that we had scheduled for this portion of the program, Cambodian-American Luan Ung. So we will reschedule this interview. Luan Ung, the author of two books, First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers. Her latest, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. Again, we'll reschedule this interview. In the meantime, this afternoon, we're going to go to the archives and we'll rebroadcast an interview from last month with John Koski, author of The Confederate Battle Flag. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look into the bitter debate over the Confederate flag. How was it transformed from a battle flag of the Civil War to the uses and meanings it has today? How should we regard it? Our guest this afternoon, historian John Koski. He is the author of The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem. Koski says a careful exploration of the history of the Confederate battle flag reveals the fundamental disagreements among Americans about our past, our present, and our future. And he says this: the Confederacy was the most important organized and armed dissent in American history since the Revolution. The conflicting attitudes toward it reflect accurately the divergent views on constitutional and racial issues that have persisted from the 19th century to our own day, despite the Civil War and despite the Civil Rights Movement. John Koski is historian and library director at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. His book, The Confederate Battle Flag, grew out of an exhibition at the museum in the 1990s. He says the guiding question for the exhibition, which was called Embattled Emblem, and for this book was this: what does the viewer need to know in order to understand the modern debate over the battle flag? John Koski's book, The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem, is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. John Koski, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thanks for that wonderful introduction. You framed it very nicely.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm curious about what the response was to the exhibition at the museum about the Confederate battle flag several years ago.
It was varied, as you would expect, and perhaps also as you would expect, the Museum of the Confederacy. We get Civil War buffs from all over the nation, all over the world, largely from the non-South. But generally, it's a selected audience. It's people who are interested enough in Civil War, specifically Confederate history, to go to the trouble to come here. So it's people who, I think, it's safe to say, are predisposed to think more positively than the average sample of Americans of the battle flag. And since the exhibit was painfully objective in an effort to avoid speaking in our own voice but what we may think as individuals or a collective, the response was amazingly good. That is, we expected that a lot of people would have axes to grind and would be disappointed or even indignant that we did not take a defense of the flag, that the exhibit was not an overt or even covert defense of the flag, but an effort, as you read earlier, to understand it, and that people would react hostily to something that didn't come out in defense of the flag, but instead most people appreciated that objectivity and felt that that was the way to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, reading your book, I think that some of my ideas about the flag shifted a bit. And I think that if you look at the history of it with some objectivity or try to, the sting of it is lessened.
The It's interesting that you said that. I suspect it has a lot to the way you anyone responds to the book, and will depend a lot on, of course, any preconceptions you have coming into it. And I suspect, while it may take the sting out for those who perhaps were inclined to think critically of it before, for those who have always revered it in a kind of uncritical way, I expect, at least I hope, that the reaction to the book is to suddenly realize that maybe it is not as benign a symbol as he or she thinks. So I expect it's sort of kind of counter-cyclical, if you will. It's whatever you enter into, whatever you have as your preconception, I hope and assume that to some degree any preconception will be dispelled by this book.
Yeah. It was interesting to learn that the Confederacy had a number of flags, national flags, battle flags, and naval flags. How different were they from one another, and how was it that the flag we all recognize came to be the battle flag, the Confederate flag?
Boy, I'll try to answer that efficiently. I could keep us all on here for an hour. It makes it a heck of a problem for nomenclature, what to call, because I know full well that there are people who know lots about Confederate flags out there who think that on the face of it, a book that talks about the Confederate flag or the Confederate battle flag, know it to be an oversimplification, which it is. So the flag that I'm referring to by the Confederate battle flag, and the Confederate flag for that matter, is the one we all think of, the blue cross with the white stars on the red field. And even though there are any number of variations on the shapes and sizes, whether it's square, perfectly square, rectangular, and the like, I'm referring to all of those flags of that pattern, which originated as the battle flag to be used by Confederate armies, specifically in Northern Virginia, what later became Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. It is not what we call the Stars and Bars, even though that name is frequently, almost always, by headline writers, applied to that flag. The Stars and Bars, properly speaking, is completely different. It's one that resembles most closely and very explicitly the Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horizontal red and white bars, two red, one white, with a blue canton, like we have in the U.S. flag, with a pattern, usually circle of stars representing the number of states in the Confederacy. That was the Stars and Bars, the first national flag of the Confederacy adopted or de facto adopted in the spring of 1861 as the national flag of the Confederacy, used as a national flag and also used as a battle flag by military units on the battlefield. But you can see immediately that because it so closely resembled the U.S. flag, that it created identity problems, and which is exactly the opposite of what you want with a battle flag, which is supposed to identify units, friendly and enemy, clearly. So the battle flag, as we call it, the blue St. Andrew's cross, was adopted as a battle flag, offered as a battle flag, in order to be distinct in its appearance on the battlefield. And at the same time that the Stars and Bars became a liability on the battlefield for the practical reason that it wasn't different enough, it became a liability politically and culturally, as the Stars and Bars, which was originally adopted because it resembled the Stars and Stripes, an effort to in a sense, wean the Southern people away from the beloved flag of the old Union, as the Southern whites majority became more nationalistic, more Confederate, if you will, they needed a symbol that was more Confederate. And they adopted in 1863, midway through the war, a new national flag that was nothing more than a white field with the battle flag, the red flag with the blue cross, up in its upper left-hand corner. So in a sense, what we call the battle flag became the motif, the only motif on a field of white, of the national flag that the Confederacy adopted midway through the war. And what I contend, then, is that the battle flag was, even during the period of the Confederacy itself, a national flag, if you will, because it was the only element on the national flag, a national flag that was adopted in order to say to the world that the Confederacy is feeling more nationalistic, that the people of the South have a greater sense of their independence now.
So almost from the very outset, it is both practical and symbolic.
It was, and it what I contend, and other historians, another book written by historian Robert Bonner, independently arrived at the same conclusion, that the battle flag to call a battle flag only a military flag, the flag of the soldier, which is part of the discussion and the debate of the flag today, is that it shouldn't be a symbol of Confederate nationalism because it was only the flag of the soldier, is incorrect. Yes, it was the flag of the soldier, but the rub is in that word only. Clearly, it was a symbol of nationalism, in part because it was consecrated by the blood of the soldiers. And the soldiers, of course, kept the Confederacy alive. And Robert E. Lee's army in particular, successful as it was, is what is the army that defended the nationalism, defended the sovereignty, the independence of the Confederacy. So it's an artificial thing to try to somehow divide the soldier's flag from the national flag, especially when you look at the second and then the slightly modified third national flag of the Confederacy, and you're staring the battle flag in the face.
Yeah. And at the end of the day here, you note that your conclusion is that the flag is an American flag, but it should be seen as a memorial, not as a symbol of sovereignty.
It's something.
Something
I would
like
rephrase
that
a little
okay.
bit. In making recommendations, and I try to present this book as much as possible. It's a lot of analysis of the history, but it's a historical work. But I stated as sort of a conditional. Those who want the flag to be revered, I think it's if what you want is for this flag to be revered as much as possible as a symbol of the Confederate soldier with whom it is so closely associated, and not as a symbol that is associated as it has been. Much of the book, of course, is dedicated to showing its changing use and meaning and how it became associated with the Ku Klux Klan and with white supremacy in general. But if you want to use it as a symbol that means the Confederate soldier, then it has to, in its current use, it has to be used exclusively as a memorial and historical symbol. And the more it is used outside of those clearly memorial and historical contexts, the more impossible it is going to be to control its meaning. And conversely, the problem as such that people who revere the flag now face is that for much of the last half century, or beyond the last half century, the flag has been used so widely in so many different contexts is that those who revere it have lost control of it. At one time, in the early 20th century, the people who revere that flag regard it as a symbol of the Confederate soldier, pure and simple, its only significant meaning, more or less owned the flag because they were able to restrict its meaning. It didn't fly on state flags. It didn't fly, with one clear exception we can talk about in a little bit, it didn't fly as widely. It didn't proliferate in articles of clothing. It didn't. It wasn't flown in political or sovereignty contexts for the most part. So those who regarded it as a memorial symbol more or less owned it as that kind of a symbol.
Yeah, well, there's a picture in the book. One of the photos in the book is of a young woman identified as Miss Dixie.
Yes, 1951.
She's wearing a Confederate flag halter top.
Yes.
When did the flag become a pop culture symbol?
In earnest, in the early 1950s, that picture from Life magazine, that's one of the significant things about it. We're not talking some homegrown Southern publication. Life magazine, along with New York Times, and oh, for that matter, papers, and I have a picture of my files from Springfield, Illinois, with a Boy Scout troop. The rebel troop with battle flag patches and battle flags, and they were sent by, this picture appeared in the Montgomery, Alabama newspaper with the caption to the effect of how proud the South was to providing these things back to the land of Lincoln, and how ironic it was. But in 1950, 51, early 52, there was a nationwide flag fad along the lines of the hula hoops and the coonskin caps and all the other early mid-1950s fads, and it got national attention. That was the real explosion of it, and that in turn traces back to the mid-1940s when, through the auspices, as typically happened and happens still, college students, the flag had a presence on Southern University campuses, and as those schools went to play against Northern schools in intercollegiate athletics, what better symbol of the South when the South was going to play the North, when, particularly when the University of Virginia went to play Penn in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, in 1947. What can we bring with us that communicates that we are from the South as we invade Pennsylvania again, as we did back in 1863? And this time we're going to win. But a battle flag. And it was sort of through that auspices, and at the same time, more sinister, I suppose, word I tend to use a lot in the book, the in 1948, the Dixiecrat Party, the Southern States Rights Party, that was a reaction against Harry Truman's support of civil rights legislation, nominated Strom Thurmond for president. And at the convention in Birmingham, once again, college students who had become accustomed to using it in this sort of hijinks way, kind of playful way on campuses, brought it to the convention floor and waved it along with pictures of Robert E. Lee, clearly symbolizing their opposition to civil rights and support for resistance to civil rights. So all these things kind of converging, roughly in the period between 1948 and 1951-52. So by the end of the 1950s and the beginning of the Civil War centennial observations in the 1960s, there were several different strains of thought and use happening. There was a kind of trivialized Miss Dixie kind of use, Confederate flag halter tops and clothing items and the like. There was a political use, a very clearly white supremacist political use. There was also the continued use of the flag as a kind of shorthand, immediately recognizable logo for the South. And then there's what we can kind of call the Dukes of Hazzard, good old boy, redneck biker mentality of people who use the flag not just for regional identification, but kind of a symbolism of rebellion, of individual freedom, of rebeldom in general, derived from the rebel states of the Confederacy. And that was all pretty mature by the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. It's also interesting to think back to realize that before the 1950s, at the close of the 19th century, a campaign to enshrine Confederate flags coincided with a campaign to establish the Stars and Stripes as a prime symbol of American patriotism.
Yeah, one of the things that we wrestle with today in why this issue is so complex in this modern political, the forms that it takes, whether it be this, the so-called T-shirt cases, the run-of-the-mill T-shirt cases in which students are suspended for wearing Confederate flag T-shirts to school, and they often find their way to court for free speech, or whether it be the state flags of Mississippi and Georgia, or the flags over the domes of the capitals of South Carolina and Alabama, or the sort of the state and local versions of the same, is that there was this period between roughly the 1890s and the 1950s, not coincidentally the same period of Jim Crow, in which African Americans in the South did not have a voice in Southern politics as a rule. But during that period, the nation as a whole came to accept the white Southern Confederate viewpoint that it was possible to have what they called a double loyalty or a dual loyalty. That as long as white Southerners were loyal to the Stars and Stripes, which they were, particularly in the Spanish-American War, as a sort of a symbol, symbolic coming back to the fold of the Stars and Stripes as Southern soldiers fought in that war. And of course, in our own centuries, white Southerners and Southerners in particular, white and black, are more heavily, disproportionately represented in the American military than other regions. As long as that is true, as long as it's clear that the Southern whites are back in the Union, they were permitted to express a kind of dual loyalty to the Stars and Stripes in the present tense, but to the memory of the Confederacy as symbolized significantly by not the Stars and Bars, but by the battle flag. That became the object of reverence. And so a national consensus, which again coincided with Jim Crow and essentially the federal government allowing the South to manage racial affairs in its own way without interference from the federal government. During that period, the battle flag was accepted as a kind of second American flag. It was Southerners realized that it wasn't their national flag anymore. Most Southerners did. But they could honor its memory, and in fact, American presidents honored its memory as a symbol of the fighting man of the Southern past. And during World War II, it was kind of playfully honored by servicemen as the flag of Lee and Jackson, and being brought to bear, this fighting spirit of Lee and Jackson and other Confederate military heroes being brought to bear on behalf of the American war effort. So with that kind of background, that's the background that underlies so much of the controversies today. Like it or not, that several generation period allowed white Southerners to more or less have it both ways, to be loyal Americans and loyal to the memory of the Confederacy. So the effort to scale back the presence of the Confederate flag on the symbolic landscape is, in a sense, kind of going back on a bargain that was never in writing, for sure, but it was kind of a cultural bargain.
Yeah.
And now we're as African Americans did find their voice and were given political rights and able to speak up against this symbol as they would have if they could have 50 years before, they're sort of in the position of the aggressors. They're the ones who are saying, no, it's not all right, even though it has become accepted for several generations.
Yeah, and it's not all right because it's a symbol, one can argue, a symbol of a movement, a nation that wanted to fight to subject people, to continue to subject people to enslavement.
Yeah, that's the question. One of the questions is whether it has an inherent white supremacist or racist or association with slavery, and you and I would never be able to get complete agreement among listeners to the show in the nation as a whole, because it all has to do with an argument that will never win a consensus. That is the role of slavery in the Confederacy. Now, what I argue in the book, and try to be very judicious in making this argument, is that slavery was the cause of the Confederacy's or the Southern states' secession. It wasn't the cause of the war, but it is very clear to most professional historians that Southern states seceded in order to defend slavery. The war came really more over the fact of whether or not the federal government recognized the legitimacy of secession. Therefore, states' rights, in a sense, was the cause of the war. But the existence of the Confederacy had everything to do with the protection of slavery. And so the argument would run that the military forces that kept the Confederacy alive, especially after emancipation became a war aim of the North, roughly halfway through the war, then the Southern soldiers, whether they thought they were doing so or not, the effect of their fighting was to preserve slavery, because you can see how many steps you have to take in order to associate the flag with slavery, and some people would reject the conclusion, therefore the Confederate flag is a symbol of slavery, because countervailing all of this is a pretty clear evidence that the average Confederate soldier was not a slave owner. Most, by far, the majority were not, and most of the Confederate soldiers fought for things that soldiers fight for in every war, for defense of home and hearth, because they feel it's their duty to do so. So your average soldier who marched under that flag, whose blood consecrated that flag, was not consciously or explicitly fighting for slavery. But we, looking back, know that the effect of their fighting was to perpetuate slavery. And whether or not that is enough of a link to say that this flag is a symbol of slavery is open to debate. What to me is more convincing and more important in the long run is that when, 80 years later, in the 1940s, when again, after this period of federal acceptance of Jim Crow and segregation in the South, the federal government began to move against segregation, and white Southerners reacted against the federal government, they reached for the Confederate flag. Oddly enough, it maybe isn't so oddly, that a symbol that in the 1860s was the predominant nationalistic symbol of white Southerners as they resisted federal government's interference with their way of life, that is, slavery. 80 years later, when once again the federal government was going to interfere or trying to interfere with their way of life, that is, segregation, the most predominant symbol that white Southerners reached for as a symbol of protest was the Confederate battle flag. And it wasn't just the Klan. We tend to marginalize the racist or white supremacist use of the flag. A lot of people try to marginalize it by saying that it was just the Klan, and the Klan shouldn't be allowed to define this symbol. I agree, a client shouldn't be allowed to define the symbol. But then we're faced with the number of ordinary white Southerners who use the flag as a symbol of protest. It wasn't the Klan that defined it. It was the ordinary white Southerners who defined it as a symbol of resistance to integration.
Yeah. Why didn't the Klan's use of the flag flat out discredit it?
I'm sorry, I missed.
Why didn't the Klan's use of the flag flat out discredit it?
The flag? Yeah. Well, it's a matter of interpretation, I suppose, the most basic is that should we allow a fringe group that we as a society properly regard as a fringe group that they're small in numbers, they've been largest in numbers in the 1910s and 20s at a time when they did not use the battle flag. They used the U.S. flag and they used the Christian cross, which continue to be their main symbols, along with this blood drop symbol. So the Confederate flag has not been the flag of the Klan until the late 1930s, early 1940s, among their symbols. But why should we empower the Klan, this fringe group that we hold in contempt as society, why should we empower them with the ability to define a symbol that means something very different to many, many, many more people than they are? That is, why should the white Southerners who are descendants of Confederate veterans whose men consecrated, whose blood consecrated this flag, have to forfeit and abdicate the meaning to a bunch of kooks and hoods? That's the argument, and I find that convincing. But also the fact that the Klan did not use the flag for all those years. And I guess it comes down to ultimately whether you allow a fringe group to define a symbol at the expense of other meanings held by many more people.
Yeah. Well, you know, thinking about this, one begins to think about the controversies over the Stars and Stripes. Same kind of thing happens.
And that's the one of the arguments made by Confederate heritage activists who involved in these debates is if the Klan's use of the flag, I've forgotten the word you used earlier, but it so marginalizes the flag or so invalidates the flag that therefore we can't fly it again because it is the symbol of the Klan, well, then we better not use the Stars and Stripes anymore, should we? We shouldn't use the Christian cross anymore. Why is it that we haven't, that we allow the Klan to own or to define the battle flag and not allow them to similarly define the U.S. flag, which they've used for a longer period and more frequently?
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, historian John Koski. He is the author of The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem. John Koski is historian and library director at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Before we get back to our discussion with John Koski, let me remind you that the Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of eastern Illinois and central and northern Indiana effective this Friday afternoon and evening until 8 o'clock. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 80 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch. One of the ways that we can maybe tease out or bring into focus the symbolic and practical meanings of the flag is to think about the impact of a flag's capture. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about that?
The flags that were used in the war that by the Confederate units, and you've alluded one of your first questions to the variety of flags, I should take this opportunity to clarify that there were lots of different battle flags used by units of the Confederate Army. shapes and sizes and patterns that most people today would not recognize. But whenever a flag was captured by the enemy, it was essentially a trophy. And because the battle flags as battle flags were so important functionally to the military units that carried them, allowing their commanders and other men on the field to gauge the positions of troops and to clarify battle lines and to keep men the battle line straight, literally and figuratively. But they also had an incredible emotional value. They were essentially the fabric bearers of the men's esprit de corps. They really did mean something. We tend to kind of make light of this because it's something of a cliche from a Civil War movie that the men who moved forward, the color bearers, of course, being so obvious on the field and such obvious targets, and they were targeted. And one man's shot down, and another man picks up the staff before it hits the ground, and he has his head blown off, and another man picks it up, blood-stained flag. It happened often, and that's one reason why this flag has such incredible meaning for the men who fought under it and for their descendants. And because it was so meaningful to them, the assumption was, usually safely, that if someone else captured that flag, that must have been a hell of an effort to have captured it, or that the unit to whom it belonged must have been so decimated that it signifies the enormous success of the men who captured it. So in the U.S. Army, men who captured Confederate flags in the Civil War were awarded the Medal of Honor. And then they, in turn, were supposed to turn the flag into the War Department, and they became a trophy in the War Department. And in the turn of the 20th century, those captured trophy flags, more than 500 of them, were turned over by the War Department to the governments of the southern states that had carried them.
Hmm. There's a photo in the book of Marshal Sherman.
Ah, yes, very controversial Marshal Sherman.
Yeah, and he was with the 1st Minnesota Infantry. Mm-hmm. In this photo, he's standing in front of the flag that he captured. And you note in the caption that a century later, huge controversy about where that flag should be housed. Apparently, Sherman borrowed it from the War Department and never returned it. So it found its way into the Minnesota Historical Society collection. And Virginia comes along and says, it's ours.
Right. Yeah, it's. I don't know if it's made headlines up your way. I know it has in Minnesota, and it's something of a perennial issue. This group of reenactors from Southwest Virginia, or the Roanoke area, where some of the companies in the 28th Virginia were raised, have asked for it back. They made this rather peremptory demand of Minnesota to return the flag at a rather inopportune time when there was a certain former wrestler as governor of Minnesota, and Jesse said no, but and kind of lighted the fires there. But and then our current governor, Mark Warner, has been imposed upon, along with Senator George Allen, both of these men mentioned as presidential candidates, by the way, who have been kind of brought into it to, in polite tones, say that they too think that it belongs in Virginia. The Minnesota Historical Society has the flag and is taking good care of it. And the argument, of course, that Minnesotans make is that not only the old kind of 90% of the law of possession, but another percentage, that 82% that the 1st Minnesota lost of its men at Gettysburg, that in a sense it's part of Minnesota's history that Marshal Sherman and his comrades captured that flag, losing 82% of their numbers at Gettysburg. So it is clearly a part of the lore of that unit of the state of Minnesota. I think that's an understandable argument. The fact is, however, that there has been a pattern, not only by the War Department in 1905 and 1906, turning flags over to the states and directly to our museum, by the way. We received the Virginia's flags, and we received all the unidentified flags in those years. But that states since, including Illinois, as you probably know, may be heading in this direction next, has in its possession a handful of captured Confederate flags that have not been turned back to the Confederate states. And Confederate heritage groups want them back. In Minnesota, in the case of the 1st of the 28th Virginia, in Illinois, in the case of a handful of flags, has been sort of defying a trend ever since 1905 that northern states and individuals and descendants of men who captured them and didn't turn them in after all have made these sort of grand gestures of reconciliation to southern states, to, in a sense, shake hands across the bloody chasm by turning back the flags, and it's not appropriate to keep symbols. So with that kind of momentum building, Minnesota has defied it, and so has Illinois. And to the annoyance of some of the more active heritage, Confederate heritage people, both in the South and there in Illinois as well, we've received some correspondence and phone calls asking to enlist our help in getting the flags back from Illinois.
Hmm. What do you think about that?
Try to be apolitical on that. I don't feel like I understand the politics of, and I'm sure there's small p politics going on involved in this. And I guess I can see the other side, that these are part of the heritage of the capturing states as well. I don't think it's ever going to be settled by force, if you will, or by compelling them, the states or the historical society, to turn it over. It's going to have to happen by the consent of and a decision made by the states to do it for the right reasons. Human nature has a lot to do with flag controversies. I think there's a contrariness in all of us, and you don't have to be Jesse Ventura to get your back up when somebody comes to you and says, "Give our flags back, darn it!" That people tend to dig their heels in, and if they're going to be returned, they're going to be returned through a positive gesture of consent, not because somebody is wailing at you and demanding it. So in good time, if they go back, that would be the right thing to do.
Yeah. Well, it's an opportunity, it would seem. It could be an opportunity for a discussion about what this all means and how we should regard this controversial symbol today.
It could be, and in a positive way, it could be. The return of the flags is because you have so many different parties involved, some who have standing, such as in a legal sense, and some who do not, who are kind of making noise from the outside. But it could be. And in the case of the captured flags, it has to do with the morality, I suppose, the right word, the rightness of holding on to trophies of a war that was over 140 years ago. But the controversies over where to fly the flag, whether it should be flown on public property, or in what the NAACP refers to as the sovereignty context, or should we avoid at all costs flying in the sovereignty context, but allow it to fly in historical context, those are the kinds of arguments and debates that I think can, and at their best, have been very probing, useful, beneficial discussions of the meaning of history in our own time, in our own, the presence of the past in the present.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hello. Well, as a Civil War, an amateur Civil War historian, and a person who likes Civil War reenactments, I suppose I should call in on this one. The scuttlebutt is that really the first friendly fire the early Confederate flag got was in a naval battle in Roanoke, and that was what sort of propelled them to change the Stars and Stripes. And give me a follow-up. For Stars and Bars.
Stars and Bars. So the Roanoke Island fight would be in February of 62.
Yeah.
It actually, before that, at Manassas, at First Manassas or Bull Run, you all called it up there.
Yeah.
In July of 1861, there was a friendly fire incident in which I think it was Jubal Early's men were fired on. It was a Mississippi regiment that was fired on as they were coming up from behind, and the commanders weren't sure on this hot, sultry day whether they were friendly or enemy troops coming up on the rear. And immediately after that is when General Beauregard and General Johnston, the commanders of the Confederate Army, petitioned to Congress to consider changing the national flag to something more distinct, and Congress, not surprisingly, refused. And so that's when they resolved to come up with their own battle flag. And the man whom I credit with being the sort of the father of the battle flag, William Porcher Miles, had South Carolina, was serving on the staff of General Beauregard. And we have some of the correspondence in our library here at the museum. In early September of 1861. And not coincidentally, at the very same time, elsewhere in the Confederacy, because of very similar kinds of incidents or fear of that kind of incidents, other Confederate commanders were coming up with very different designs for the same practical reason. So I don't know about the Roanoke Island friendly fire incident, but by that point, the battle flag as we think of it today had already been distributed to the Army units in Northern Virginia.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You know, it's so interesting for those of us that are involved in Civil War reenactments. We all would rather be Confederates than Unionists, even though my own personal politics, you know, I'm sort of a radical lefty, but I love Civil War reenactments. Once you've done them, you'll never go to another 4th of July celebration. It's just, they're just stunning, you know, for listeners, and they should go out and try to do it. My favorite one was always up in Boscobel, Wisconsin, but 600 horsemen.
Well, let me ask you this. Why is it that so many people, North and South, want to be Confederates?
Well, now, okay, excellent question. And I think the answer is there's always more romance in losing a war than there is in winning it. And that seems to be the thing. Also, there's always better music around the Confederate camps in the evening at Civil War reenactments, the good old full-time fiddle and banjo music. And that's what I play, by the way, as a musician. That's always been my role.
Confederates are more fun, in other words.
Yes, that's exactly it. But everybody in Civil War reenactments, it's not the politics of the thing, you know. It's strictly a way of participating in history. It's the smoke, it's the sounds, the running horses. They're dangerous. You know, most of the Civil War reenactment guys, they're all school teachers, college professors. You have to be wealthy, you know, just to outfit a infantry soldier, you know, is close to $5,000.
God.
You know, so it's, and if you're a horseman, well, you have to almost daily fire your black powder weapons around the horses, because so they won't be gun shy during the reenactments, and that they're also into weaponry. So it's interesting that the stars and bars have become, you know, this symbol of slavery, but for the Civil War reenactment people, who are all mostly center or left of center on the political spectrum, don't have a problem with this. So it's just a contradiction, and I thought I'd bring it up. And thank you for your very interesting talk today.
Thank you for your question.
Thanks for that call. When did people begin reenacting Civil War battles?
In the centennial period, there was an organization, shooter organization or marksman organization called the North-South Skirmish Association, which doesn't do full-scale reenactments, but it's a shooting competition using black powder weapons that began, I believe, in the 1950s, maybe before. But during the centennial period in 1961 is when there were large-scale reenactments frowned upon by some of the officials of the war, of the centennial, who did not want to romanticize the war too much. Also, were dubious of the educational value, the memorial value of reenactments. So there was quite a bit of discussion about that in the early 1960s, and also about the authenticity of some very bad uniforms that were worn then. And it's grown, as he alludes to, very expensive, and it can be a very educational. And the people who were involved in it, there's a lot of integrity among a lot of people who were involved in it for their passion for authenticity, for the look and the feel of the hobby.
Yeah. Well, there we have to leave it. We've used up the time, I'm sorry to say. Wish we had a little bit more time this afternoon. Thank you so much, Mr. Koski.
I appreciate the opportunity again. Thank you for talking.
Historian John Koski has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem. The book is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And that interview was from the archives. We talked with Mr. Kosky on May 13th of this year. We had scheduled this afternoon an interview with Luan Ung, a Cambodian-American survivor of Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia. We will reschedule that interview for a later date. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here with the numbers, Todd Gleason.
You betcha. Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, the rain is in the forecast, and the prices are lower at the CBOT as the day ended this afternoon. On the grains floor, July futures in the wheat pit like this, 319 for the high, the low at 313. Settlement price there at 313 and a quarter. They were down three quarters, or rather down 6 cents today. September futures, 328 and a half on the high, the low at 323 and three quarters. Settlement price at 324 and a quarter. They were off 5 cents for the day. December futures in the wheat pit, 339 and a half, the high, the low at 334, settled at 334 and a half, off 5.5 cents. In the March contract in the wheat pit for this afternoon, 349 on this Wednesday for the high, the low at 345, settlement price at 345 and a half, and they were down 4 and a quarter. We don't have the high and the low, but we do have a settlement price for the May wheat, $3.49 a bushel, down 4.5 cents. From the corn pit, July futures today, $2.19 the high for the nearby, the low at 214 and three quarters, settlement price at 216, they were down 4 and a quarter. September contract at 228 high, low at 224 and a quarter, settled 225 and a half, down 4 and a quarter. And December futures in the corn pit, 237 and a quarter the high, the low at 233 and a quarter. December corn settled the day down 3.5 cents at $2.34 and three quarters of a cent. March futures now 245 and a quarter on the high, the low at 241 and a half, settled 243. They were off 3.5 in the May contract, 249 and a half the high, the low at 246 and a half, settlement price at 247 and a quarter, down 4 cents. In July futures for next year, 250 and a half the high, the low at 251 and a half. July 2006 corn contracts settled at 251 and a half next year's, down 3.5 cents. July oats, 145 and three quarters the high, the low at 142 and three quarters. Settlement price there at $1.44 and a quarter, up a half for the day. September contract 1 cent higher, 149 was the settlement price, the high at 49 and three quarters in September. Oats at 148 and a half on their low. Once again, $1.49 was the settlement price, up 1 cent for the SEP oats for the day. Soy complex now, nearby July soybeans, $6.76 the high, the low at $6.66, settled 667 and a half, down 7 and a quarter. August futures, 678 and a half on the high side, the low at 668 and a half, settled $6.69 and three quarters. They were off 8 cents today. And the September futures, 681 the high, the low at 671, settlement price there at 672 and a quarter, down 7.5 cents. November contract, 685 and a half the high, the low at 675 and a half, settlement price at 678, down 7.5 cents. And the January soybeans, 685 and a half the high, the low at 677 and a half, settled 677 and three quarters for that January 2006 soybean contract, down 7 cents on the day. And the March futures for next year down 4 3/4 in the bean pit, 671 and three quarters the settlement price, the high at 676 and a half, the low at $6.69. A couple of things to remind you of coming up this Friday morning, June the 10th, USDA will release its next world agricultural and supply demand estimates. We'll have all the details all day long here on the agricultural programming at WILL AM 580 this afternoon at about 6 after the 2 o'clock hour, about 12 minutes away. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services of Oakland, Illinois. Be sure to tune in for that. And some things a little further out that you might want to put on your calendar at this time. August the 18th, that's a Thursday, is Agronomy Day here on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus, your opportunity to come and speak with the scientists and researchers and extension outreach folks that are providing information all the time through things like the PMCDB or the bulletin online from University of Illinois. That can be found at ipm.uiuc.edu/bulletin. That's August the 18th. Starts at 7 a.m. in the morning, runs right through 2 o'clock hour, and your opportunity to speak directly with the scientists that are doing research on everything from corn and soybeans to wheat to the aphids that you might deal with, and something else we might discuss a little bit later today, the two-spotted spider. Trader, Mike. Probably haven't heard about that one for a while, but the folks at the entomology department here have been talking about it at least last week just a bit. Gives you some idea what the dry weather conditions might be like across a good portion of the state of Illinois, parts of Indiana, too. That little creature hasn't been around in force, at least, since about 1988. July bean meal now, 211.10. The settlement price there down 3.10 for the day, 215.50. The high, the low at 210.50. Once again, $211.10 the settlement for the July bean meal, 3.10 lower. August contract down 260. 215.50 the high as well, the low at 211 even, settled to 1140, down 260 for the August bean meal. July bean oil, 23.20 the high, the low at 22.92, settlement price at 22.98, that was off 8 cents, and the August oil, 23.26 the high, the low at 23.02, settlement price at 23.08, and it finished 11 cents lower. Now, here from at AM 580 with the numbers, I almost put you in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange, Celeste, as opposed to here in the studio. But nonetheless, you have those numbers for us this afternoon.
I do, and I'm going to get to those numbers in just 1 second. But I want to remind our listeners that a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for portions of western and central Illinois until 5 o'clock this afternoon. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes DeWitt County in Illinois. Now let's take a look at the numbers for livestock. August feeder cattle, the high today 113.35, the low 112.60, the settlement 112.80, that down 72.5. September 111.80, the high 111.20, the low 111.67.5, the settlement, that finishing down 45. October 110.45, the high 109.90, the low 110.30, the settlement, that down 45. June live cattle 84.97.5, the high 84.40, the low 84.60, the settlement, that down 45. August live cattle 83.35, the high 82.80, the low 83.22.5, the settlement, that down 20. June lean hog 67.30, the high 66.70, the low, the settlement 67.12.5, that up 30. July 69.12.5, the high 68.30, the low 69.05, the settlement, that up 97.5. August 68.25, the high 67.20, the low, finishing at 68.17.5, that up 97.5. And October lean hogs 59.70, the high 58.95, the low, the settlement 59.42.5, that up 65. July belly 72.20, the high 70.70, the low 71.72.5, the settlement, that finished down 2.5 cents. The Dow is now off 11 points at 10,472, the NASDAQ down 8 at 2059, the S&P 500 off 3 points at 1194.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jonathan Christian from Livermore, California wants to know, dear Dr. Science, if space is a vacuum.